we are in subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 841 modifies the requirements for benefit levels of basic health benefit plans for small employers.
Okay. Senator Clarno, would you please come up, and Senator Morris and Rick Bonetto, the three of you come up together. And Rick, you're going to explain the amendment. Or Mike. Sorry about that, Mike. There is a Rick on the list, and I should know that. Mike. Whoever.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Bonetto. I'm a policy analyst for the Senate Republican Office. Just going to go over a brief explanation of the -1 amendments of Senate Bill 841 that you have in front of you. The initial piece of Senate Bill 841 relates to the basic health plan that health insurers in the small group market must offer. And the initial language of 841 made some minor changes as to how that basic plan would be evaluated and approved. The -1 amendments that you see in front of you are really a gut and stuff, a completely new draft of that bill. And walking through the main points of that bill, on page 6, line 2, there is a specific definition of a medical savings account health benefit plan. And that is new language that we have inserted in there. And this plan will now be linked to a medical savings account with a high deductible health benefit plan, and will also be linked to Section 220 of the Internal Revenue Code. So this is what is being proposed for the new basic benefit plan. On page 7, on line 22, the new language that was inserted would require all non-HMO insurance carriers in the small group market to offer this new medical savings account health benefit plan. And it would also allow HMO carriers in the small group market to offer this MSA benefit plan. They have the option of providing that. They are not required. Okay. And the last change is on page 15. And that has to do with the portability requirements for the small group market and this basic health plan. So this the same language that was in there on page 7, but now just with the portability product, non-HMO carriers in small group market must offer this MSA health benefit plan. HMO carriers will have the option. That is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Bev Clarno from District 27. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 841 and the -1 amendments. Having been in the legislative process for more than a decade, I've seen rising health care costs force many Oregonians to lose health insurance benefits. I'm sure many of you know many constituents who have become uninsured due to unaffordable health insurance. As policymakers, we all have a duty to make health insurance more affordable and allow employees greater choice. Senate Bill 841 would help make health insurance more affordable by changing the basic plan in the small employer market to include medical savings accounts coupled with high deductible health insurance. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time, and I appreciate you listening to my testimony. Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8. I come to you today wearing probably several hats, not only as a state senator, but as a former, well, actually a current businessman, and as the current chair of Samaritan Health Services Organization. It's a 5-member hospital, in excess of 120 doctors, and an integrated hospital delivery system that encompasses the communities of Sweet Home, Lebanon, Albany, Corvallis, Lincoln City, and Newport. One of the reasons that I became involved, and I have had quite a number of years in the governance of healthcare in our Mid-Valley, and one of the reasons I became involved was a concern over the rising costs of healthcare. And as we've seen them develop over time, they continue to increase at rates that, in my judgment and the judgment of many, many people, just virtually are not sustainable. And the models of delivery, health insurance models that we have today, I think they're in dramatic need of reform. The federal MSA model was a step in the right direction. I don't believe it went far enough. Senate Bill 841 is a very small step in the right direction. And the right direction is restoring to the consumer the ability to make informed choices for themselves about health care and make those elections. It's interesting in health care insurance in that we pool things together in such a way that people don't have choices. And the MSA model provides that opportunity for people to make choices. I don't know of any other industry that we don't have really choices to make individually. In healthcare, we don't. As an employer, we offered health plans years ago when we started. We wanted to cover expenses for all expenses for employees and their families, and we did that. And what we have done is we've developed a culture of people that have an entitlement to health care from the standpoint of any service, any time, at any cost. And there is a certain individual accountability that can be restored in the MSA model, where people do have the ability to make choices and then insure themselves for the catastrophic risks that may come. When we look at insurance for housing, for example, we don't insure for the paint that goes on the house or the roof that is repaired on a maintenance basis. We insure the house for something catastrophic. And I think that a shift more in that direction is going to afford us an opportunity in this country to begin to rein in the cost of health care, because utilization of health care is a major factor in increasing its costs. So I would hope that the committee would move forward into a work session on this and give it a serious consideration, because I believe it does represent a positive step in the right direction for our state, and hopefully on a national basis we'll see additional reforms as well. So I very much thank you for this opportunity, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to move this to the top of the hour so we can get on to our other committees.
You can have lunch.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair.
Yes. Senator Stark.
Thank you for bringing this to us, Senators Carno and Morris. Two years ago, we had a Dr. David McDonald came over here to Mission Mill and made a presentation regarding a plan he called Simple Care. And at that meeting, he testified, or he told us that that this Simple Care plan that they put together is for people to manage their own medical needs, and that for $35 a family could become Simple Care members. Doctors who sign up for that then expect their patients to pay cash, and because they do, they're often able to reduce the billing by 30 to 50%. Now, it seemed like with a bill such as this that we might encourage more Simple Care members and providers. I don't know if there's a question in that, but I really do appreciate that we have the opportunity to look at this as a means of putting people back in charge of their own medical care. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I might add that I've worked on something like this, or at least tried to find a way that we could assist small business, and Dean Cordes, who's going to testify from Lane County, worked on this also. I approached our Chamber of Commerce and asked them to look at some possibilities that whether or not there could be an umbrella group, or how we might facilitate small businesses to provide insurance at a greater economy and greater service to their members. So I am very supportive of the concept, and I really appreciate it that you're bringing it for us, and we will look forward to the rest of the testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dean, would you please come up? Peggy Annette and Rick Rebel also. And we will explore the depths of this idea. Is that what you're going to do, Peggy? Get down to the depths?
No.
Welcome, Dean.
Thanks, Senator.
Welcome, Rick.
Thanks, Senator.
Who wants to lead off?
I will, sir.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Rebel. I'm a private independent insurance agent from Albany, 23 years in the business now, and have extensive background with the placement of group and individual products. Passionate about the private market, and urge your support, continued support of Senate Bill 841. What I did for you was I kind of give you a little overview of some of the key components, I think, of the bill that I picked out that I think are of key importance, and would like to kind of go through these and share these with you briefly. The first slide I tagged the three A words. And for a number of years, and I've been active legislatively since the late 80s, and back in the old days, seemed like access and availability were the buzzwords here in Washington, D.C. and here in Salem. And we've impacted access. As you know, all group plans from 2 to 25 are guarantee issue now. The federal government has made an impact, making certain that that small employers have access to private health insurance. From an availability standpoint, we do not have as many carriers in our state as we did, say, 10 years ago, but we do have a fairly robust market. Most of the carriers now that Dean and I and Peggy work with are pretty creative and are working hard to find ways to provide solid coverages for our employers. The often forgot about A word I put down there is affordability. And as Senator Starr mentioned, affordability is probably one of the key things that we need to be talking about right now. Until recently, we haven't really talked too much about it, but as Dean will testify, a lot of our small employers are experiencing 15% and 20% increases in premium every single year, and it doesn't take much math to know that within a few years those rates will double. What I've found is that a number of employees are now being asked to share a larger percentage of that premium with their employer, or their employer is elected to modify the benefits and reduce them, or a combination of those two. And I think that is more commonplace. I recently had the opportunity to go around to 7 different locations for one of my employers and talk about their new $1,000 deductible plan and the increase in the family payment. And not a real good position to be in. Fortunately, they didn't shoot the messenger, but I have to unfortunately do that quite often. Senate Bill 841, what this will do is allow small employers and their employees to take advantage of a tax law that's been on the books since 1996, and it revolves around medical savings accounts. It will conserve those precious premium dollars, reducing the economic hardship of affording cost-effective health insurance for employers' employees. In addition, it will create more choice for employees, because this will be a choice that is not currently available to them. And in addition, it will do all this without compromising any state mandates. All of our state mandates are included in this product, so therefore there's no worries about whether mental health care, as an example, would continue to be covered, because all state mandates are continued in Senate Bill 841 with those -1 amendments. The next slide, it basically all we're doing with Senate Bill 841, I believe, is restructuring our basic plan. We developed the basic plan back in the mid-1990s, and the design was for a cost-effective plan for small employers in the small employer market, and it basically was the benchmark that all the other plans would key off of. The benefits were very simple. The current basic plan says you pay 50% of the first $7,500 in bills, and the insurer pays the other 50%. In the old days, when we first developed this product, not too many of those were sold. Recently, we're finding more and more of those being sold simply for the cost impact. It's much less expensive, and many employers are finding themselves having to move to this current basic plan. The tragedy of that is the amount of money that our employees have to pay at 50% is very seldom tax deductible, and Senate Bill 841 would certainly impact
deduct and take some of the sting out of the co-share or the copay. Senate Bill 841 will also ensure availability of this plan. The nice part about SB 841 and modifying the basic plan, this is not a mandatory plan that employers have to buy. It is simply just another option, another opportunity in the marketplace. The employers and their staff, especially in the small groups, many times get together in small groups and discuss the options in the marketplace. Dean or I will bring four or five examples of plans that are available, and it's not uncommon to have employees and the employer sit down with us and discuss the virtues of each one of those plans prior to selection. All SB 841 does is add another plan to review during that selection process. Most of you are probably familiar with flexible spending accounts, or FSAs. They've been around for quite some time. They're governed under a federal section of the Internal Revenue Code, Section 125. What FSAs do is it allows an employee on a predetermined basis to allocate a certain amount of their wages to an account, and many of you might possibly personally participate in one now, but what it does is it lets me as an employee decide how much I think I'm going to spend next year for my own personal health care that's not covered by my health insurance plan. When I incur that expense, I can get reimbursed for that expense on a pre-tax basis, hence giving myself about a 30% savings. The bad part about a flexible spending account, and why I think Senate Bill 841 resolves this major issue, is the fact if I do not use that money for health insurance related expenses, I lose that money. And what happens is a number of employees are a little bit gun shy about putting money in the account if they don't think they can get it back out, if it's not a known expense. So on slide number 5, basically I kind of want to just recap what 841 will do is allow an employee to establish a personal medical savings account with their group insurance plan. If an employer selects this product, an employee has the option to open an MSA. They don't have to if they choose not to, but they'll be able to pay for all of those expenses that they might have that year on a pre-tax basis, saving income taxes. In addition, they can also purchase other coverages or other services that are not covered by health insurance, such as orthodontia for themselves or their children, contact lens solution, acupuncture, chiropractic, a number of things that aren't included in health insurance policies today. They could use those MSA funds to purchase.
Now, Rick, we're talking about federal income taxes here, right?
Yes, and the state, my understanding is the state also gives the same tax deduction currently.
Okay.
So federal and state taxes.
Okay, so we're talking about a tax credit. Well, you would a tax deduction,
correct?
Not a tax credit.
Not a credit
deduction. Okay.
No, sir.
Thank you.
As Senator Morse mentioned, it does create an incentive for good, prudent use of the system. People shop daily for a number of products. As these deductibles get higher and higher, people are shopping for care. As Senator Starr mentioned, it could create opportunities for people in the medical field to reduce their fees, and it will give me an opportunity to seek out maybe a lower-cost provider. Also, I found across the United States, MSAs are being used in a number of different states, and by the way, the federal government, as you probably read in the newspaper, is talking about lifting the ceiling anyway for larger employers, which I think would be certainly a boom for that market. The market that we're talking about today is strictly the small market. But I think in the event I have those tax-free dollars to spend, I'm going to be a little bit potentially better consumer, and then I'm going to shop a little bit and make darn sure that I'm spending my money wisely. So in closing, I would like to recap and say that I urge your support for SB 841. From a small business owner's perspective, and I am a small business owner with 10 employees, I think it will achieve some lower rates because I think over time the rates can moderate in the entire market. It would produce also some flexibility that I could offer my staff. If I'm an employee in a small business, my payroll deductions would be lower. I'm going to be able to save for my own health care on a tax-free basis without the fear of losing that money, because that money rolls over every year, and every year I can also make additional deposits to my personal account. As from the market in general, which we deal with daily, again, I want to stress the fact that it does include all state mandates, so there should be no issue there. It's another option in a very, very competitive market, and I think would create some additional competition. And again, the plan is just a benchmark plan. It just currently modifies our plan, and it is not a mandatory plan that any employer would have to purchase. Okay. I thank you for your time.
Questions? Okay. Dean,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dean Corchi. I'm here today on behalf of all the employers that we represent, primarily in the Eugene-Springfield area, although I also serve on the Health Insurance Advisory Reform Committee and president of our state association. I'd like to just start with kind of tagging on to what Rick said and also Senator Morris. One of the perspectives that we see out in the marketplace is evidenced by this number. In 2002, the number of insureds in what we call the CHI market, and that's the small employer market of 25 and fewer people, that's what we like to call in our agency mainstream America or Main Street America, where most employers are, that number declined by 5,100 people in 2002. And that's a number that I don't like to see happening. There's a book out recently, maybe some of you read it, called The Tipping Point, which is at what point do things become epidemic? At what point do we see in this market people are really dropping out of the market? And it's all around the premium of this.
Seems to me that's the current military term.
Maybe it is. I don't want to use it that way, Senator. Thank you. Senate Bill 841 addresses that. I'm here to give you some numbers. As Rick mentioned, the issue is that dilemma between increasing premium that typically the employer pays a fairly large amount of, and in our book of business, the employees pay for their own dependents, and the benefits. And we're always going in trying to balance that. We already have, in our small agency in Eugene, Springfield, 30 companies that already have this basic benefit plan in which employees are paying 50% of their costs of health care. And they're doing that for various reasons. Certainly the most dramatic one is because the premium of that plan makes it affordable for the employer to still provide this benefit. By passing Senate Bill 841 and encouraging, really is the way I read 841, requiring, I guess is another way to say it, that companies provide a medical savings account plan, does exactly as Rick said. It allows employees to put aside money on a pre-tax basis and, most importantly, carry that money over from year to year to year so they can literally manage those expenses, still at the same time having the insurance, which is protect against catastrophic risk, and manage those costs themselves from year to year to year. So in any one year, they might have a catastrophic loss. That would be picked up by the insurance. Then as they go on for 5 years building up their account, they can use that money with tax advantage resources to pay for those expenses that they can choose to pay for. It really does make sense. On the individual market, we've been selling medical savings accounts since, I don't know, I lose track, whenever they started. And they really are effective. They really are effective because it increases the consciousness. It increases people's awareness of what they pay. And under the plans that we're talking about today, when you pay 50% of the bill, and it does refer to what Senator Starr referred to, the simple plan, it makes you think about, it's a commodity like anything else. So we'd really encourage you to give serious consideration to this and pass Senate Bill 741.
Dean, how do you see this bill impacting or solving the problem? What numbers increase do you see if a bill like this passes? You say there are 30 companies in Lane County now. Is this going to be enough to tip the scale, so to speak?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Senator Moore said, I don't think there's any single answer what addresses that. I think the more arsenal, the more arrows we have in our quiver, the better are we prepared to address all of those needs of small businesses. What I can tell you is that from the small business and those businesses that enroll their employees in this decision, and that's becoming more and more frequent, people really understand the power of having some money put aside. And I think that one thing that we like, at least in our marketplace, we like choice. Mm-hmm. And if it's my choice to spend my money, it's my money. Now, that's something else. And if I'm going to go over to Peggy's money, because she's that insurance company, I'll always spend her money. That's free money. But if it's my money, that, and it's so conceptually, it's what we're dealing with. Will it, you know, will it be the magic answer? That really addresses the whole thing of increasing health care costs. Why do we need all this stuff? You know, that if I could sell, just having this conversation with Representative Farr, if I could sell hardware and every month the hardware manufacturer said you need this new crescent wrench because it's better for you, that'd be a great business to be in. That's what medicine is in. Well, now we need colonoscopies because they're better than this, or we need that because they're better than this. Well, this helps us manage those dollars for us. I think it's one of the answers, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Corchi, I have a question I need clarification on. You talked about the MSA and how you can set the money aside and mm-hmm. you can roll it over, and then you said you can use it to spend, but you didn't. I'm not clear. Can you use it to spend it on anything, or does it have to be medical related?
It's both of those, frankly. It's a very technical part of the law, Senator Walker, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you use the money for any qualified medical expense, and that was referred to as Section 220, which is an IRS section that lists qualified medical reimbursement, medical expenses that are allowed under the IRS code.
Which might include...
Well, basically, you answer the question what it doesn't include. It doesn't include purely cosmetic things like teeth bleaching and... Carolyn, my wife, kind of thinks a little jaw lift would be kind of cool, and eyelid tucks, and some things like that are not qualified expenses under the IRS code. Virtually most other medical expenses are, Senator. So if you use your money out of your medical savings account to pay for those expenses, then that has no tax consequence. That's a tax-free exchange. Under current law, under current federal law, at the age of 65, if you wait until then, you can take it out for anything and only pay income tax on it. If you take it out prior to 65, you also pay income tax on it plus a penalty, a 15% penalty, by the way, which is fairly substantial. It is not meant, and the designers of MSA accounts did not structure this to be an immediate savings account. It's meant for specific purposes, which I think is good for the country, need to save money. And this is one of those ways to do that. Did I get too involved on that?
No, actually that answered my question, and the federal government should probably take a lesson in that because we're currently deficit spending, but that's just a side comment.
I was just back in Washington, D.C. I just got back yesterday and talking with Representative Walden, Senator Smith, and DeFazio, and encouraging this legislation, which technically grandfathers in 2003 in December.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of optimism on the Hill that they will continue it on and hopefully change the law a little bit so we have a little more flexibility in how the insurance part of this law, we have some flexibility to make that more contemporary with what we really need in the marketplace. And I think there's quite a bit of interest in doing that.
Carolyn will probably have some questions for you.
She always does, Senator. She
If I could go back to your question a few minutes ago about the market, however, in general, I am getting more calls now requesting group MSAs than I ever have over the last 5 years. So from a market standpoint, I think people are asking for these, and I think the market is really wide open for us to have a huge impact. So I think the numbers would look very, very good over a period of time.
Good. Thank you. Peggy.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America. And I also am a consultant to a program that provides coverage to small employers. And I would like to draw your attention to the fact that this is a bill that I support, and you all know how often I come in and support a bill in this committee.
Thank you, Peggy.
In any event, every time I come in here, I talk about the concerns over increasing health care costs. And this kind of a model, I think, actually provides, as they've described, another solution to the problem. And I think in response to Senator Morissette and Senator Walker's discussion, one of the observations that I would make in terms of encouraging people to look at this, and employees are looking at this, and they're looking at it increasingly because of the amount of out-of-pocket costs that they're paying towards their premium. I mentioned the other day in this committee that I had seen one school district in which the employee contribution is over $600 a month towards their premium. When you get to that level of employee contribution, they're looking at alternative ways to provide their health insurance coverage, reduce that cost, but still have some a fund to pay for those expenses that may not be covered by the health plan. And one of the things to pick up on what both Rick and Dean have talked about, the money in this fund, you get to decide how it's spent. You can spend it on anything that is covered, a covered medical expense in the Internal Revenue Code, with the caveats that Dean just mentioned. That's really important to people because there is a huge variability in the kinds of services that some people like. And one of the issues that you see before you all the time, frankly, when mandates come in, where somebody may want to have one type of coverage for something, somebody else has this interest, they could care less what each other does. They want the one thing that they're interested in. And so when you have this kind of an account, particularly when it rolls over, that gives them the ability to reduce their out-of-pocket towards the premiums, as well as have some greater flexibility in selecting the kinds of services and treatments that would not otherwise be covered. And it is very clear to me when I look at small employer groups that I'm working with, everybody is struggling, both the employers and the employees. And when you see the employee interest coming back, specifically driven by looking at either the out-of-pocket costs that they're looking at towards their premium or uncovered services, these really are a motivation for people to take a look at different options in terms of the coverage that they elect. So with that, I would also strongly support Senate Bill 841 with the amendments.
So you have no objection to any insurance mandates under this system, right?
I didn't say that. No, Rick said that. I didn't say that. And you all know how I feel about mandates, but I what is the most difficult thing for us to get across, I think, is that the crisis in healthcare costs is as serious on the private side as it is in the Oregon Health Plan. And
now you don't have to have that discussion right now.
I know.
We have two other bills that you're going to be up there on anyway.
I know. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. With that, I'll be quiet.
Mr. Chair, I think what Peggy said is really important, this whole thing of flexibility. It's one of the things that Rick and I find every day in our lives when we're out talking to employers and businesses. Mm-hmm. People want this, people want that, and a decision has to be made. By allowing people to put away this money, you really have created much more choice. If a person wants to see a naturopathic physician, and that doesn't happen to be covered under their plan because of cost, by allowing this money, they now have that choice, and they don't care if somebody else does or doesn't want to. It really empowers them powerfully.
I agree. I think that's great, a great future, and I'm sure we will have a work session.
Thank you.
I'm almost sure we will have a work session. I will recommend that we have a work session. Not today, though. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where are we on now? Okay, I know. Okay, I will close the public hearing on 848, Senate Bill 841, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 491. Paul, would you like to come up and meet this? Oh, Senator Brown, is she in the room? She's not. Okay. Paul, you're the lead on this, so don't blow it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing the Cascade AIDS Project, and I'm pleased to testify in favor of a bill that will allow Peggy Emmett to come back up here and tell you how she feels about health insurance mandates. Cascade AIDS Project is a private nonprofit organization headquartered in Portland with a branch in Vancouver, Washington. It's the largest AIDS and HIV prevention and AIDS service organization in the state. And this bill deals with incentives to help develop an HIV vaccine. Progress in vaccine development in this area has been slow and oftentimes very discouraging. However, there are a couple of new promising developments that indicate some progress is being made and that an effective product will eventually become available. That points out the basic difference between this health insurance mandate compared to many of the others that you see in this committee or have seen in past sessions. This is actually a mandate for the purpose of trying to provide an incentive to vaccine manufacturers to develop a product by telling them that there would be a market for it at coverage of health insurance. This mandate would not have any immediate effect on health insurance premiums because there is no effective approved HIV vaccine. What we're hoping to do is provide provide an incentive for development of that. Two of the major drug companies, Merck and Aventis, are partnering to conduct human trials of a new vaccine intended primarily for people uninfected by HIV. A second type of vaccine development is called therapeutic vaccine, which frankly is not the kind of vaccine that we normally think of. It's actually a vaccine to be used as a treatment modality for people who have infections with HIV. But the widely held view in the community amongst the drug companies and the health officials and others is that the main problem in HIV vaccine development and the lack of interest in, with other companies is that the cost of these new technologies is great. Conducting the primary research and clinical trials are extremely costly. No HIV vaccine is ever likely to be a profitable product for a drug company, which is, of course, a major disincentive for their involvement, and that there are potential liability issues. There are a couple of major drug companies, notwithstanding the two I just mentioned, who have tabled their vaccine development efforts in the past 5 to 10 years, although there are some private organizations who are stepping in to fund better research, and to foster a better environment for vaccine development. And those include the American Foundation for AIDS Research and the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, that latter organization receiving substantial funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation recently. I note that in the bill, line 12, page 1, line 12, subsection 3, the bill as drafted provides that it is not subject to the mandate review section of Oregon Law 743-700. We don't have a position on that. I had frankly assumed the bill before that was pointed out to me today was subject to the normal review on health insurance mandates that periodically occurs. So I have no position, or Cascade AIDS Project has no position on that particular item, but we'd urge your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if I am able. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
This bill purports to provide coverage for a non-existent vaccine. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, you're correct. That's what makes it different from most other kinds of health insurance mandates, which are intended to cover a particular treatment that exists. This is intended to give a financial incentive, essentially a safety net, that if a vaccine is developed, there'll be a market for reimbursement of it, which is the incentive, we believe, that one of the package of things needed to have that research go on.
More development. Okay, so why would it apply after the on the effective date of the act once it is enacted? Why wouldn't it become effective upon the discovery of a vaccine?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I suppose that's another way to draft it. The concern, I think, was to have an incentive in place now to encourage people to do the research. But I understand your question. I think that could easily provide the same incentive.
Mr. Chairman, another question.
Yes.
Where is vaccine defined in statute?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, I am not certain of that question. I would expect there might be a definition, but I don't know.
I suppose, Mr. Chairman, I don't disagree with the premise of the bill or what it's attempting to do, but I would suggest that there may be some unintended consequences of enacting a mandate bill for what we believe to be a non-existent vaccine when the definition of vaccine is not yet defined for statutory purposes, that then opens the door to a broad range of interpretations and hence some potential lawsuits relevant to what a vaccine is. I mean, it sounds somewhat of an ethereal, tangential discussion, but I think it is.
Well, it seems point. To me that it would be the Food and Drug Administration's approval of a drug that would be suitable for whatever, for the purpose. I mean that would be the defining feature of an effective vaccine, would be defined by the Food and Drug Administration.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, for the record, State Senator Kate Brown, if vaccine is not already defined in statute, which I hope that it is, I anticipate that in working towards getting your support, we can do an appropriate definition that would be appropriate for this bill.
All right.
Okay, Senator Brown, further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown, I did not hear Mr. Cosgrove's testimony, so I apologize if I'm somewhat redundant. I really very much appreciate this committee giving this matter a hearing. Over 2.5
21.8 million people have died of AIDS globally, and according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, new AIDS cases in the United States rose by 8% from 38,000 in the year 2000 to 42,000. We need an all-out effort to develop a vaccine. This bill requires insurance companies to offer that those that provide drug benefits to include the AIDS vaccine in that benefit when a vaccine is developed. As Mr. Cosgrove testified, it would motivate pharmaceutical companies to invest in the research for a vaccine, and we think develops a coordinated, guaranteed market conducive to stimulating the investment of needed dollars for research and development of a vaccine. The bill has no current fiscal impact, which is one of the beauties, and I would urge your support of this particular measure and look forward to working with you on it.
Paul, do you understand the process, the approval process of developing a vaccine? Are you...
Mr. Chairman, not in great detail, but in some general manner, yes.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Are you aware of vaccines that are... of development of potential vaccines? Are there some in the pipeline that you're aware of?
In fact, Mr. Chairman, there are two tests that were scheduled to run with potential vaccines under FDA testing procedures that unfortunately were just withdrawn because the initial testing before they went to widespread human use found that it did not develop the level of antibodies necessary to be an effective vaccine. And of course, every vaccine has a potential harm, and you want to make sure it's an effective vaccine before you start immunizing people. So I don't believe we are at that point yet. As a matter of fact, I'm certain we are not at that point yet.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Peggy Arnette and Barney Spade. Barney, would you please come up? I guess the FDA would take those.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. First, I'd like the committee to know that I think the end goal behind this bill is laudable and something we all look forward to the day that there is, in fact, a vaccine for AIDS. We have some deep concerns about this bill in the fact that it does, in fact, place in the statute an insurance mandate for an unknown drug or drugs, the cost of which are unknown, and to some extent, the efficaciousness of the drug is not necessarily known. As I understand it, Mr. Chairman, FDA approval for a drug or a vaccine has to prove two things. One, that it's safe, that is, it doesn't injure people, and two, that it's efficacious in the sense that it's better than a placebo. What we don't know about the vaccine technology for AIDS now or in the future is what array of choices there may be in the vaccine armamentarium, but this nonetheless anticipates that one or more would be mandated. That gives us deep concerns. I guess lastly is that this bill also does not reach to state sponsorship for persons under the Oregon Health Plan or under Medicaid who are suffering from AIDS or for whom an AIDS vaccine in the future would be useful. I understand the last comment of Senator Brown that it doesn't have a fiscal impact. I would submit that if it did reach to the Oregon Health Plan and others on state sponsorship, the fiscal impact would be unknown, primarily because no one knows what the cost or use rates of the vaccine would be. For those similar reasons that gives us concern, it might give fiscal policy makers in this building equal concerns. That's the extent of my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Okay. Peggy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And I echo the comments of Barney and Senator Brown and Mr. Cosgrove in the sense that I think we're all looking for some sort of effective vaccine for AIDS. What I handed you today were a couple of articles, and one deals, it's an ethical discussion of what's going on with regard to AIDS vaccine. That's one that is entitled AIDS Vaccines Immune to Quick Success. The other one that I gave you was an article entitled Doubts Deepen Over the Safety of AIDS Vaccines, and that actually gives you a description of what happened to the trials that were just withdrawn. And those were to supposedly involve some 11,000 volunteers at a cost of something like $60 to $80 million. And this gives you, that gives you a technical discussion of what's going on. But the significant point, going back to what Senate Bill 491 does in terms of requiring coverage for any vaccine, is summarized in this article that deals with the ethical question. And the issue in this, as stated, once the efficacy of a vaccine is established, how good must it be before it's made widely available? On one hand, anything is better than nothing, especially in the face of public health emergency. But wise resource allocation demands that we ask whether it makes more sense to spend millions of dollars on a marginally beneficial vaccine or invest in producing something more effective for the future. And it's for reasons like that we really need to be careful when we move towards actually mandating something that does not yet exist, and we don't have the ability to weigh the issues that are attendant with the kinds of vaccines and the cost and the populations that they serve. I really think that this is an issue that should wait for a future discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair. Ms. Annett, I appreciate these articles. I was reading through them, but I love the quote from Jonas Salk that you have no chance of success unless you are willing to fail. And that's what we do a lot in this process. So I think it's very apropos. Thank you.
Thank you. Others wishing to testify? Seeing none, I will close.
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. I wanted to get a clarification. I'm not sure who could answer.
Clarification for somebody. Would you come back, please?
I don't know if Barney's the guy, but and I kind of raised the question so that maybe the committee staff can look at this, because I'm looking at Chapter 433 in the Oregon Revised Statutes, and it talks about vaccine education. In that chapter, it talks about HIV and hepatitis. And there's kind of a quasi-definition of vaccine that says vaccines include vaccines, immune products, and chemoprophylactic medications. That's the extent of any definition I can find in the statute. Now, but I guess because it's been a long time since I've dealt with this subject, the difference between HIV, which is referenced in statute, and the acquired immune deficiency, because I think there is a difference, if I understand correctly, between the progression of that particular malady. And I think that's important as we get into the definitions. Should this pass, what do we mean in Chapter 433 where we talk about HIV as opposed to what we're mandating as it might relate to acquired deficiency syndrome? So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Menes, I cannot answer that question. I think you raise a good issue, and I'll be more than happy to work with Ms. Taylor and others to make sure that if the bill were to pass, that at least it defines appropriately the targeted disease at the right stage.
Holly Robinson may help facilitate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 491, and I'm going to do a cap hearing on a number of bills, all of which we will not hear, but we are going to set them aside. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bills 324, 368, 440, 56, 539, 540, 541, 567, 600, 636, 659, 669, 684, 796, 769. Wow. 806, 814, 839, 840, 875, 884, and 886. And now I will close the public hearing on...
I have Senate Bill 600, Mr. Chair.
On... Okay.
Okay.
No, did we... Okay, I know. Is this... Okay. Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324, 386, 440... Or 368, I'm sorry. 440, 506, 539, 540, 541, 567, 600, 636, 659, 669, 684, 769, 806, 814, 839, 840, 875, 884 and 886, and if I got some random numbers in there, we will have hearings on them. Close the public hearing. Get your finger out of the...
I'm here to help.
I know. Okay, I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 236.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 236 prohibits insurers from restricting, excluding, or reducing coverage or benefits under health benefit plans on the basis of sex and requires insurers to cover prescription contraceptives to the extent that other prescriptions are covered. In your packet, you have a dash one amendment that Joel Area from the Insurance Division will explain to you with regard to technical amendments to the bill. You also have a letter from Michelle Mattern, and I believe that you've already received testimony from Bob Castagna from the Oregon Catholic Conference, which also included a dash two amendment.
Did we hear this bill once before?
No.
No. No. The first time we've heard it.
Representative Rosenbaum, Labor Commissioner Dan Gardner, please, would you call Joel up to you?
Oh, come here.
And Joel, if you would like to come up and sit in, Diane, our Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to lead off?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Representative Diane Rosenbaum, representing House District 42, and I'm appearing today as co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, which is a bipartisan group of legislators and advocates on issues that affect women's health, safety, and economic well-being. And actually, we believe that Senate Bill 236 spans all of those areas. It's a great pleasure for me to appear today in support of Senate Bill 236, because this year, 2003, is the 10-year anniversary of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, which was founded in the 93 legislative session. It also happens to be 10 years that we have been trying to get a form of a bill passed like the one in front of you today, and we believe that when you've heard the testimony, you'll agree with me that it's long overdue, and there are many good reasons for you to pass Senate Bill 236. The bill with the dash one amendments, as Mr. Ariel will explain shortly, is a very simple bill that simply will say that insurance plans in the state of Oregon that cover prescription drugs must cover prescription birth control to the same extent they do any other prescription. We think that's a matter of basic fairness, and in fact we like to call this a prescription for fairness, because we think that birth control is part of basic health care for women for most of their adult lives. And in fact, we know that unintended pregnancies represent half of all pregnancies that occur nationally and in the state of Oregon, and almost half of those unintended pregnancies end in abortion. And by covering prescription birth control and making it more affordable and readily available to the women of Oregon, we can reduce the need for abortion, and we can ensure planned and healthier families as a result, which we think is good for everyone in the state of Oregon. We know also that this is an economic issue for women, because women have, on average, 68% higher out-of-pocket costs for health care than do their male counterparts. And a large part of the reason for that higher expenditure is the lack of coverage for prescription contraception. We also know that in addition to all the arguments that we've made for the past 10 years, there now are some very good reasons why the state of Oregon should do this at this time. In the year 2000, there was an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ruling that said that it is sex discrimination not to provide coverage for prescription birth control if employers cover other kinds of prescriptions. And that was followed in June of 2001 by a federal court ruling in the state of Washington that confirmed that it is sex discrimination. So we now know, and we made this argument shortly after that decision came down, that we have employers at risk of being sued in the state of Oregon for failing to provide this coverage. Many of them may not be aware of that. Many are becoming aware of it, and they are choosing voluntarily to provide this coverage. But as we predicted in the last legislative session, we knew it was only a matter of time before a lawsuit was filed in the state of Oregon if we failed to act to do this legislatively, and that has in fact now happened. We do have a lawsuit that's in court at this moment against an employer in the state of Oregon for failing to provide this coverage after being asked to do so voluntarily. So in addition to all the good reasons to do this as part of fairness, as part of basic health care for women, we now have a reason to do this to protect the employers of the state of Oregon, too, because we don't believe that employers should have to be sued in order to provide something that can be done as such a simple matter of law. So for all of those reasons, we want to join the 20 other states in the country that have now, by law, required that this simple change be made, and we think that it's long past due to do that in Oregon. We think the women of Oregon have waited long enough to have a prescription for fairness, to have basic health care, to have the coverage that is provided by Senate Bill 236, and we would urge you to agree with us and support this bill and send it speedily on its way to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Just the cases you cited? Do you have the references or the addresses for this?
Yeah, I think Commissioner Gardner will provide that for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm glad to be here today in support of Senate Bill 236. Actually, Senator Minnis, in 2001, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington found in Erickson versus Bartlett Company that an employer-sponsored prescription plan that covered most drug devices used by men but excluded contraceptives used by women was a violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, as amended by the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. Oregon parallels that law in Title VII of ORS 659A.030, a statute within the Civil Rights Chapter covering unlawful discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodations that prohibits employers from treating employees differently in terms and conditions of employment because of factors such as their race and their sex. As employers, an employer whose actions may not be intentionally discriminatory but which have a disparate impact on employees based on sex also violates ORS 659. The federal court in Erickson case applied the disparate impact analysis, and it finds that an employer's insurance plan that excludes contraceptives used by women was discrimination in violation of Title VII. The Bureau supports the principle of non-discrimination in employer-sponsored prescription drug plans that was established in Erickson. In addition, it's more likely than not that a court would rule that 659 prohibits the denial of prescription contraception coverage in the employer's otherwise provided prescription drug benefit plan to their employees. As Representative Rosenbaum stated, that family planning services for Medicare beneficiaries have been in place since 1973. There are 58 million women of reproductive age in the United States, and they do spend 68% more in out-of-pocket expenses of health care than men do.
and lack of prescription drug coverage is the biggest contributor to that disparity. Since 1998, over 20 states have passed legislation related to insurance coverage on contraceptions. The legislative remedy to this disparity does best belong in the insurance code, as stated in Senate Bill 236, as it addresses how coverage to insurance to insurers should be applied. This really is a pretty straightforward gender issue that should not wait for the courts to correct, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear here today.
Thank you. Senator Mintz.
Commissioner, do you know if the Erickson case is being appealed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I'm being told it's settled. As you are, too.
Okay. So, and it's your position that Chapter 659 already covers this issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I believe under 659 it can be. The one thing to remember about Chapter 659, though, that creates difficulty in making this bill makes it more straightforward than 659 would. 659 relates to how the Bureau can regulate actions of employers. Since most insurance companies are a third-party participant, they buy their insurance from a third party, it's more readily addressed under the insurance code.
But again, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, your statement here seems to say that 659A030 covers the issue. So, and this relates to employers. Why wouldn't you be able to enforce under that statute?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, we would be able to enforce if we can show that the employer, in purchasing their insurance from an insurance provider, went through and decided what would be covered and what would not be covered under prescription drug coverage. Under this bill makes it much cleaner in showing that those employers who do provide prescription drug coverage for their employees must provide this type of coverage.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, another question.
Yes.
Do we know how disparate impact is defined? And is that term from the Erickson case, or is it from some other area of the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it was used in the Erickson case, but I'm not familiar whether it is in other parts of the law as well or just used in the Erickson case.
All right, but let me go back if you can, Mr. Chairman. You used the term in disparate impact on employees based on sex also violates in Chapter 659. For Oregon purposes, is there Oregon case law that defines the disparate impact question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, not as it relates to this particular subject that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Joel?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I know that you have a number of citizens here that want to testify on this bill, so I'll try to be as brief as I can here. Diane's described well, I think, what the bill does. It says that if an insurer provides coverage, or if an insurance plan provides coverage for outpatient prescriptive drugs, it must include prescription contraceptives on the same basis. It's really very simple concept. The history of this bill for us is we've always supported the bill, or at least have supported it for the last three or four legislative sessions. We have not sponsored the bill in the past, but we are sponsoring it this time in response to a request from the current governor. And mostly I think it has to do with the kind of dialogue that just went on between Senator Minnis and Mr. Gardner, and that is that there is a growing body of law that says that it is discriminatory not to provide this service in a typical insurance plan that covers prescription drugs. But when you get into the details, we spent a long time with the Attorney General, both my shop and Dan's shop, last year trying to sort out whether either of us had administrative authority to do this. And there's arguments that we do, but there are also some nooks and crannies that are difficult. And so we thought the best solution was the most straightforward one, which is to bring it to the legislature and resolve it cleanly and clearly here. So that's why we brought the bill forward. I'll just make a couple brief arguments in favor favor of the bill. I think Diane covered well the broad public policy reasons for the bill. One is that you'll note that the insurance division typically does not get involved in mandate issues in the legislature. Those are difficult issues of comparing costs and benefits and making tough public policy trade-offs. One of the reasons we're here on this bill is because it's not a mandate bill. It's a simple parity bill. Prescription drugs do not have to be prescription contraceptives do not have to be covered under this bill unless other prescription drugs are covered. So it's a parity bill, not a mandate bill. Secondly, we think this issue is about discriminatory action rather than about cost cutting. Sometimes I hear from insurers that this is a bad bill because it's simply going to increase the cost of health care. But if you look at a situation where prescription drugs, prescription contraceptives are excluded from a health policy today and ask the question, why is that done? Is it a cost-cutting measure or is it a discriminatory measure? I think it's hard to argue the cost-cutting side of that, because if you line up all the different things that are covered in a traditional insurance plan and then look at which are the most cost-effective and which are less cost-effective, contraceptives clearly come way up on the list as a cost-effective sort of treatment. So if you're looking for things to cut out of a health plan to save money, this would be one of the last things you do cut out of the plan on that basis. It's cut out of plans for reasons other than that, and when courts have looked at those reasons, there are some, I recognize, valid moral issues here, but courts have said it basically comes down to a discrimination issue, and we think that's the correct analysis, and so that's another reason why we bring the bill forward. Finally, Marjorie said that I talked briefly about the amendments. The Dash 1 amendments do two things, both of them pretty technical in nature. The first is on lines 11 and 12 of the printed bill, we introduced the basic operative language of this bill with a statement about how insurers may not restrict or reduce coverage on the basis of sex. That raised questions from insurers about whether we had some broader issues in mind in this bill than simply contraceptives. We did not, and so that language, which came from a Washington statute originally, was seen as superfluous to our effort here. This bill is aimed just at the issue of prescriptive contraceptives, not at any other issue of sex discrimination, and so that introductory language is deleted in the Dash 1s. And then secondly, the bill currently uses the phrase comprehensive prescription drug coverage as the marker for when the requirement to give equal treatment to contraceptives kicks into action, and we thought in discussion with a lot of people that a more accurate marker is a plan that includes coverage for prescription drugs on an outpatient basis. That's a more precise term than the term comprehensive drug coverage. So that's the other amendment that's embodied in the Dash 1s. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Senator Minnis.
So, Joel, I thought I tracked with what you were saying. And looking at the bill, and I'm asking myself why it couldn't have just been limited to a restriction that an insurer may not exclude or reduce coverage or benefits of a health plan based on sex. And that could have been the entirety of the bill, rather than raising the issue of contraceptives. But you say you narrowed it to contraceptives because the insurance industry thought there might be some other underlying motivation. Am I tracking with you?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, yes. The broad phrase sex discrimination within insurance raises a lot of issues for people who are familiar with insurance law, and there's a number of different kinds of disputes you could get into on that, and we didn't want this bill to become a vehicle for that broader discussion, so we focused it down just on contraceptives.
Joel, if discrimination is the true motive here, or that we're trying to overcome an inherent evil of discrimination, and if, in fact, there is discrimination based on sex, why wouldn't we talk about those broader issues? Why would you simply narrow it to contraceptives? Is there discrimination in other areas of insurance coverage based on sex?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, there may be reasonable people disagree on that in relation to some other issues. This one we thought was clear, and so we wanted to focus on this one in this bill. Were we to bring in other issues where those kinds of claims are made, there would be, I think, much more disagreement among different parties, and none of those, to our mind, are ripe for decision in the legislature in the same way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Joel, you're the insurance commissioner. So you made a political choice to narrow it to contraceptives as opposed to deal with the wider issue of discrimination. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metz, I don't think that's exactly accurate because there aren't any other specific issues that I'm aware of that anybody had in mind. It was more of the kind of discussion of, well, what else might come under this? Well, we don't anticipate anything else coming under it now. Well, then why do you say that? Well, that's a good point. Let's not say it because we don't have any other issues in mind. And so it's more on that basis that we took it out. There are no, you may know some, I don't, that
well,
sort of lurking issues.
I'm asking you because you're the one that regulates this and that's what I'm trying to get out of you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minutes, I know of no other specific issue that anyone's raised with us that might or might not come under that broader language. I can tell you about disputes in other states and other situations, but I know of no particular issue that we're trying to exclude from this bill now on this basis. We simply were trying to get rid of some kind of inference that there were some other issues out there that we were trying to pick up on the sly, so to speak.
Well, I for one can certainly understand why Joe wouldn't have those in mind. If in fact we want to pursue the question, we ought to be asking the insurance industries that seem to have the concerns, and not necessarily you.
Well, this happens to be an insurance division bill.
Yeah, I know, but they approached him. He didn't approach them about other concerns. And if they have other concerns, they can bring them to us. What's before us is this issue, which we are clear about.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Menace, if I could just clarify, too, partly this bill came about because in the interim, after this issue was discussed last legislative session, the state of Washington did adopt an administrative rule that would require this coverage for the state of Washington. And I then, in turn, wrote to Mary Nidick, who at the time was the director of Department of Consumer and Business Services, and asked her to adopt the same kind of rule for the state of Oregon. That resulted in seeking legal advice and finding that the Attorney General didn't feel comfortable that we had the authority just to do that by rule. And so the whole intent of this and my writing to them was to seek something that would make sure that we weren't offering a discriminatory insurance product in this respect. I think, and you probably know this better than I because you've been around longer than I have, there have been other discussions in this building from time to time about whether gender could be taken into account in rating people for purposes of auto insurance or whatever, and that's definitely not what we were trying to get at. And to my knowledge, that's not a settled area of the law, whereas the failure to provide prescription birth control, if you cover other prescriptions, is now clearly a settled area of law.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, it's even probably on the other side, and there are many places right now in the law where sex is a specifically included variable in considering things, in life insurance and auto insurance and so forth. So,
well, we're getting into, Mr. Chairman, we're getting into the black box issue with insurance companies and the ratings, and whether it's a valid assumption or not, and statistical merit, so on and so forth. But that's really a different question. You don't know of any procedures that are not allowed in terms of sex discrimination.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, that is correct. I'm not aware of any specific health procedure. It's more these broader questions that Diane raises about what can and cannot be used in rating of various types of insurance.
One other question.
Yes, and then Senator Fisher after you.
How many complaints has your division received on this particular issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, to my knowledge, not a lot, but we receive some. In general, the insurance industry provides its coverage in most of its benefit plans, so this is not a major change in the marketplace, but there clearly are situations, as Dan suggests, with the lawsuits and so forth, where it's not provided, so there are occasional complaints.
All right, thank you.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joel, you made a statement that concerns me. You indicated when the question was about other issues of perhaps sexual discrimination, you had mentioned that reasonable people had talked about. Does that mean that anybody disagrees with you on this as an unreasonable person?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, that was certainly not my intent, and it probably was not well stated for the reason you just suggested. So I apologize for the way I stated that.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to move along. Elizabeth Kennedy Wong, Barb Arnold, and Ken Henry, would you please come forward? Okay, we're going to try to get through this next five or six people before the witching hour of three. So if you could keep your testimony relatively brief, I'd appreciate it. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Kennedy Wong. I'm the board president of Oregon NARAL, and I'm also representing the Pro-Choice Coalition of Oregon. I just want to say that I appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I wanted to note for the committee that in addition to this hearing room, which is full of supporters of this bill, there's also an overflow hearing room, which is also full of supporters. So,
welcome, everyone in the other hearing room.
Yes, welcome everybody. Thank you.
The Pro-Choice Coalition of Oregon strongly supports Senate Bill 236, which would end current discriminatory insurance practices by requiring that birth control be treated like any other prescription medication. Birth control is not a luxury for women. It is basic health care. It is essential to the planning of our families and preventing unintended pregnancies. Half of all pregnancies in Oregon are unintended, and more than half of all unintended pregnancies end in abortion. Contraceptives have a proven track record of enhancing the health of women, preventing unintended pregnancies, and reducing the need for abortion. Unfortunately, the most effective forms of birth control are not accessible to many women. Many insurance plans provide no coverage for prescription birth control, even when there is coverage for other prescription medications such as Viagra. In 2000, a survey of employers conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 13% of workers enrolled in HMOs and 40% of workers enrolled in conventional fee-for-service health plans did not even cover the pill, much less all the different FDA-approved methods. As a result of this policy, women on the average spend $573 of their own money on birth control. There is no question that women pay significantly more than men in out-of-pocket health care costs, and that's just not fair. Providing contraceptive coverage is also becoming a legal necessity for businesses. In December 2000, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ruled that employees who are denied insurance coverage for birth control are being discriminated against on the basis of gender. In December 2001, a federal district court in Seattle ruled in the case of Erickson versus Bartell Drug Company that an employer's exclusion of prescription birth control is a violation of federal law. Additional cases are pending before federal district courts in California and Atlanta. Since 1998, 20 states have passed comprehensive laws or regulations that address the discriminating practices in private insurance company for coverage for birth control. Legislation such as Senate Bill 236 is needed to prohibit insurance plans from discriminating against women by excluding prescription birth control from prescription medical benefits. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ken Henry. I'm an ordained Presbyterian pastor. I've served churches in Washington, California, and now in Oregon, and I've been ordained since 1988. As a member of the faith community, I strongly support SB 236, which would require that health insurance plans end the discriminatory practice of excluding prescription birth control from prescription drug benefits. Birth control is basic health care for women. It is essential to planning our families. More importantly, access to contraception helps prevent unintended pregnancies and reduces the need for abortions. Today, I'd like to focus my testimony on the issue of religious refusal clauses. Last session, the Catholic Conference attempted to insert an additional religious exemption clause into the contraceptive equity bill. I urge you to oppose any such amendments and pass SB 236 out of committee in its current form. There is no need to create an additional exemption because current Oregon law works. ORS 435.2 ORS-225 and ORS-435.235 already provide for a true conscience clause by which practitioners may refuse to accept the duty of offering family planning and birth control services to the extent that such duty is contrary to the personal or religious benefits of the employee. Instead, their supervisor must make arrangements to ensure the eligible person receives information and services from another employee. While I believe that individual choices should be respected, I think our first commitment is to patients seeking medical services. The linchpin of a true conscience is true conscience clause is that while an individual provider may decline to provide a service, the patient will receive the service they seek. Healthcare providers have a duty to ensure that women receive accurate information and appropriate care. Failure to provide this care jeopardizes women's health and violates bedrock principles of medical ethics. Refusal clauses violate informed consent principles. When health insurance companies and managed care plans withhold information about health options, they violate principles of medical ethics, informed consent. Under this doctrine, patients must be informed of the risks, benefits, and alternatives to treatment. The American Medical Association has emphasized that the patient's right to self-decision can be effectively exercised only if the patient possesses enough information to enable an intelligent choice. Failure to provide full information about all relevant medical options, even for religious reasons, violates standards of care. In Brownsfield versus Daniel Freeman Marina Hospital, a court ruled that a rape survivor who was denied information about emergency contraception at a Catholic hospital emergency room could sue for medical malpractice. The court asserted that a woman's right to control her treatment must prevail over a hospital's moral and religious convictions. Further, it is the hospital's duty to provide full information about all medical options in order to protect patients' right to choose whether to undergo medical treatment. As the court stated, meaningful exercise of this right is possible only to the extent that patients are provided with adequate information upon which to base an intelligent decision. Broad refusal clauses trample on the consciences of individual health care providers by prohibiting them from providing information, referrals, and services they believe are in the best interests of their patients. For example, if the legislature enacts a broad refusal clause for insurance companies, an insurer may refuse to cover sterilization, counseling, referrals, or services. A physician in such a plan who determined that a patient could face life-threatening circumstances if she became pregnant again, that sterilization would be in her best interests, would be prohibited from providing the woman the appropriate information, referral, or treatment. In conclusion, I urge the committee to pass SB 236. Oregon is overdue in providing fairness for women in prescription drug coverage. Thank you.
Chairman.
Yes. Senator Minnis.
This citation, Brownfield v. Daniel Freeman. Where is that at? Is it federal court? Is it state court? Where was that decision?
I'm not sure of all the details behind it. It's just kind of used as a basic illustration of what could happen.
And it's worthless if we don't have an actual citation or where to find it.
Federal court citation. I'll get that for you.
Would you? Well, thank you.
I also would like to see that because I'm kind of curious about institutional conscience and if and how it exists and under what circumstance. Other questions? Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Arnold, and I am the Patient Services Co-Director at Planned Parenthood Health Services in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also a registered nurse and have been so for 27 years in the area of maternal and child health care. I'm here today to advocate for the passage of Senate Bill 236. Each year at our Planned Parenthood clinics, we provide thousands of Oregon women the birth control services that are so essential to their lives and their well-being. Years of experience has shown us that when contraception is definitely affordable and accessible to all women, they will seek these services and they will enhance their health and prevent unintended pregnancies, which are always a concern to women during their fertile period of life. When contraception is mentioned, most everyone thinks about the pill. However, I want to emphasize to you today that we have a very impressive range of contraception that is now available to women. As you already know, I'm sure, not one contraception, not one pill, fits all women. Part of our role in our clinics at Planned Parenthood is to help our clients assess their best-suited health contraceptive measure. This assessment leads the women who come to us as clients with the opportunity to make the choice that is best suited for them and for their bodies. And when there is choice, we have found that there is more compliance. And compliance is key. Without compliance, there will be an unintended pregnancy. I would like to familiarize you today with some of the new choices that have been made available so that you would not believe that the pill is the only form of birth control. And I do this based on medical necessity, because the pill cannot be utilized by women who are smokers over the age of 35. The pill should not be utilized by women who have a history of cancer. The pill should not be utilized by women who have migraine headache histories, nor with chronic hypertension. Can you imagine how many women this eliminates? So, in addition to the pill, and I would be happy to share these with you, we also have a book that we use with our clients that demonstrates the variety of methods. If you would like that, I'd be happy to share it and pass it down. We have a new method that is known as the NuvaRing. The NuvaRing looks like a pill, only it's larger. It's inserted in the vagina, and it is used for a month at a time, a very effective contraceptive measure. The pill, the one that you are all familiar with, it comes in a variety of estrogen, progesterone combinations and is used sequentially month by month. We also have the intrauterine device for women who need more of a permanent sterilization measure. This is a very, very acceptable and highly effective method. The Depo-Provera injectable, which lasts for 3 months at a time. And the latest, and now prescribed by 1 in 10 physicians, we are told, the patch. It looks like an oversized Band-Aid. It's placed on the woman's extremities, and she can utilize this for a week at a time. There's the diaphragm, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And it works if you can get it out of the case.
So it's not foolproof, right?
I myself was astounded when I was educated in all of the methods of birth control. And I am delighted to be your health educator today and to bring you up to the current status of what is available. Because all women cannot use the pill, it is essential that this law include the liberty to acquire any contraceptive method that is medically, and I underline the word medically, appropriate for that individual, and to have the counseling that goes along with that. All of these methods that I have just shown you are extremely cost-effective compared with the direct medical costs of an unintended pregnancy, which is now $9,000 to $14,000, depending on the type of the delivery, $14,000 being a cesarean section. Over a 5-year period of time, the savings are tremendous. This has already been acknowledged by the individuals who have testified today. We know that many of our clients do not have insurance coverage, and we now, with grants that are available, try to assist as many of those women as possible. But those who do have insurance coverage should also have the right to acquire the contraception they need so that they can continue their career path and work alongside of all individuals in our economic structure today here in Oregon. So I urge you, as a healthcare provider and an advocate for the very best healthcare in our state, to please support Senate Bill 236.
Mr. Chair,
I would be happy to share any of this with you if you would like to see them.
Yes, Senator Waters.
I have a question. It's good to see you again, Ms. Arnold.
Thank you.
You do quite well in your new job.
Oh, thank you.
I have a question for you because Senator Minnis asked a question of Mr. Irio, the insurance director.
Yes.
And he asked him how many complaints he got from women where their insurance carriers did not cover contraceptives. I just sort of inferred from his question and from the answer that Senator Minnis maybe thought this wasn't important enough for women to complain about, or that there weren't enough women that felt this was an issue to complain about. Let me ask you this. How many women come into Planned Parenthood on a monthly basis, yearly basis, however you want to break it down, to seek your services because they don't have insurance coverage for contraceptives?
I would be delighted to get that figure for you. It is one that we would pull off of our computer, in fact. We have exact figures to that effect. In general, it will be high. I can tell you that right now. We have 58,000 client visits per year in our 5 Planned Parenthood clinics that are from our affiliate. And of those, I'm going to venture to say that 8%, without my statistical background with me, are private insurers. It could be as high as 10%. We can break that down further and then demonstrate how many have insurance, but they are still paying cash independently for their contraception. And we also can tell, as an adjunct piece of this, that they have to watch their budgets very carefully. They are employed, they have insurance, but they can only buy, for example, 1 pill pack or 1 NuvaRing packet at a time because their budget does not allow more than this. And when you consider that as well, that means that they have to be compliant in another way, and that is get in the door to get their new contraception before the old one is gone or run out. Just like we try to be attentive to getting our oil changed on time, they must do that. And how many of us get our oil changed on time? It's imperative when you are trying to prevent a pregnancy that you get in and then also deal with the barriers of the hours we're open, etc. So if there could be contraceptive parity, if there was coverage by the insurance companies and we could actually sell 3 months at a time, 6 months at a time, we think that we would see a greater drop than we have already seen in unintended pregnancies and therefore less need for abortion.
Thank you. And Ms. Arnold, I have to laugh because I tried to time my self-breast exams with my oil changes and it just never seemed to work because I never got the oil change.
Is this a women's discussion or what? Let's talk about Viagra now.
Lush in the room, but we'll talk about that soon.
Well, and okay. We would also be happy to leave one of our books behind for you if you would be interested in using it as a resource as you make your decision.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to one of the statements that Elizabeth made about the coverage. Many health insurance plans provide no coverage for prescription birth control when they coverage Viagra. How many insurance companies do that strange turnabout where they cover Viagra and not health or birth control?
I don't have that information, but I can get it to you.
Well, I'm interested, yeah, because it seems illogical that that would happen, but...
It is illogical.
It is illogical, but there are lots of illogical things going on.
And, Mr. Chair, I actually have that question on my pad to ask of any insurance lobbyist today.
Peggy?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, yes.
I'm just curious. You've rested heavily on discrimination. Why is it discriminatory to get a month at a time? I have to remember to go get your prescription on time. I have to do that with any prescription I have.
I don't believe it's discriminatory. I apologize if that was the reference that was suggested. What I was saying was it makes it more challenging for a woman to get in and make sure that she doesn't get pregnant because the timing is so critical that she have available the very next day of contraception if she's using a pill, or that she initiate her next patch on her patch change day, which is 7 days after the last one ran out. So having more than 1 month at a time is like buying an extra dozen eggs. You don't want to run out of what you need for your breakfast. It's having it on hand. It's just making better sense to have that safety net because the consequences are so great if you are not covered and you do indeed become fertile.
Well, you can always rely on the rhythm system in case you need to.
Well, I won't comment on that.
We have 3 minutes. So we're going to have to hurry because we have five.
But I have one last question of Ms. Arnold, and you can be quick in your response. You do see a significant number of married women in the clinics, do you not?
Oh, absolutely we do.
Good.
No question about it. Thank you for asking that question.
Thank you. Paula Crane, Rose, and Laura Johnson Carson, please. And then we have three more after that. I told him that I wouldn't hear that. I don't want an opinion. So he said he wouldn't stop.
Oh, here's
my I couldn't resist.
Okay.
Introduce yourself, please.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Morissette and committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on SB 236. I am Paula Crane, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is a nonpartisan, grassroots political organization which encourages informed citizen participation in government and provides information and activities for voter education. The League is a longtime advocate of prescription drug equity, and we support SB 236. I'm going to just skip to the last sentence or last couple of sentences because you've heard almost everything I have to say already from other people, and say the League firmly believes that this inequity and this provision of health care benefits should be corrected, and SB 236 addresses this issue. We urge the committee to vote SB 236 to the floor with a favorable recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to testify today in support of SB 236. For the record, my name is Alyssa Rose, and I am representing Rejuvenation, Inc. today. We want to make sure that the committee knows that there are businesses and business leaders that support contraceptive equality. Rejuvenation is a 26-year-old Portland-based business. We manufacture and market period lighting fixtures and house parts. We have very profitable sales, which include a retail store in Southeast Portland. Our diverse workforce includes almost 200 employees representing over 20 countries of origin. We're self-funded, and we have annual sales of about $25 million. We believe prescription coverage of contraceptives is a smart business move for three reasons. And I might add that we do currently provide this coverage. I want to make that clear. Providing coverage for contraceptives is cost-effective. The Washington Business Group on Health estimates that not covering contraceptives in employee health plans would cost businesses like ours 15 to 17% more than providing the coverage. In our analysis, we estimated that providing contraceptive coverage would reduce the direct and indirect costs of unintended pregnancies. These costs include expenditures for birth, abortions or miscarriages, as well as wages and benefits for employee absences, maternity leave, pregnancy-related sick leave, and replacing employees who do not return after a pregnancy. The second reason we believe this is a smart business move is that it supports the health and well-being of our employees. As mentioned before, women pay 68% more in out-of-pocket health care than men, and most of this is due to the costs associated with birth control. Providing this health care coverage costs us less than $1.50 per month per employee, and we believe that contraception is essential to women and families because it allows parents to plan for their children. The third reason, though less tangible, is critical in how we view the overall health of our business. We believe that providing contraceptive coverage has potential benefits of recruiting and maintaining a diverse workforce. We believe coverage for contraceptives is good business policy as well as good health policy, and we support SB 236. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Laura Christine Johnson Corson. I'm here on behalf of Michelle Mattern. She's already submitted written testimony. She couldn't be here today, so I'm going to abbreviate her remarks. Okay. Ms. Mattern is an employee of the City of Eugene. She's a resident of Springfield. She works for the city attorney's office. She is paying off her graduate school loans, helping her fiancé go to law school. So her budget is tight month to month. The City of Eugene did not cover prescription contraception up until about a month ago. She brought a claim with the EEOC against the City of Eugene. The City of Eugene, their law office, their city's attorney considered this claim for a couple of months and they reversed their position. They did a thorough legal analysis of the Civil Rights Act, of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, and concluded that as an employer, they would be required under the law to change their insurance practices. So they have, as a result of her claim. She is not the only woman in Oregon to have brought a claim against an employer for this practice. There's currently a class action suit in Portland in federal district court. It's likely that these women are also going to succeed. The trend in Oregon and in federal courts across this land is a recognition that a failure to cover contraception, prescription contraception, has a disparate impact upon women. Senator Menas asked this question. Unfortunately, he's not here to hear the response. I'm an attorney, but not an expert in employment discrimination. Essentially, disparate impact is a neutral policy on its face that has a disparate impact upon a class of persons. So, no prescription contraception is neutral on its face, but it clearly impacts women much more greatly than men in terms of their health and planning families. That's why the courts have held that it has had a disparate impact on women. In closing, I'd also like to point out that there was a 1995 journal JAMA article that studied the cost to employers of paying for 15 different types of contraceptions as opposed to the cost of unintended pregnancies. And employers saved thousands of dollars each year. And insurance companies save thousands of dollars each year by covering the cost of these contraceptive methods. And it's, I think, a fairly valid study, and it's worth some consideration by the committee. In conclusion, I would ask this committee send this bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for the insights and definition of the disparate act. Thank you. We have three more persons wishing to testify. Ramora Rex, Astrid Newell, and Marcia Kelly, please. Oh, and if the people in hearing room C would please move into this hearing room B, because there is another hearing to be set up in hearing room C. So please evacuate immediately. I was going to tell Andrew to go in and get him, but he left. Yes, go ahead. Who wants to start?
Okay. Hi, Chairman Morissette and members of the Health Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Ramona Rex. I'm the Population Committee Chair for the Columbia Group of the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club with 22,000 members statewide. And we are in support of Senate Bill 236. Previous individuals have already provided a lot of the information. I know that I've had the opportunity to meet with some of you individually. I just want to amplify on a couple of things that have been said regarding the importance of contraceptive coverage to women's health. Dr. Anita Wilson with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists testified before Congress on September 10, 2001, and in her testimony, she cited that the lack of appropriate contraceptive choices is one of the greatest barriers to effective contraceptive use, and went on to say that the consequences of unintended pregnancy are serious and impose tremendous burdens on women and their families, and went on to cite the health effect to the fetus, citing that women who did not intend to become pregnant are more likely to delay seeking early prenatal care and more likely to expose the fetus to poor nutrition and harmful substances. The reference earlier to the Washington Business Group on Health, which found that there is a 15 to 17% increase in costs actually to employers for not covering contraceptives. Wanted to mention a little bit about that organization. They were founded in 1974, and they're the only national nonprofit organization exclusively devoted to representing the perspective of large employers. These are Fortune 500 companies, providing insurance coverage for more than 39 million U.S. workers, retirees, and their families. So I just like to say that I'm in agreement with those who have spoken earlier in support of Senate Bill 236, and I hope that you will consider passing it and will indeed pass it to the floor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Marcia?
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Just to remind you, the Women's Rights Coalition includes members of the American Association of University Women, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, Delta Kappa Gamma, the YWCA of Salem, the Older Women's League, and the National Organization for Women, as well as individual members. We have members from Nissa and Wallowa County to Lakeview, the coast, all over. This issue is very important to our members. No woman should have to pay out of pocket for contraceptives or methods of birth control that should be covered under prescriptions if prescriptions are in their policies. It makes it difficult if money is tight, and we know that that is the case. You've heard that before. I would also think that it would be more difficult to go in on a month-to-month basis if you're in a rural area, because we already know that in some rural areas the access to health care is more difficult. The cost of just taking care of a child for the 18 years for an insurance company versus the $300 to $500 of the cost for the insurance company to take care of a child within the coverage that would be provided is not at all comparable to the approximately $25 that it would add to the coverage for the company's cost for paying for the prescription insurance. I think most of the other issues have been talked about, but I would just remind you that we have thousands of women in our member organizations who believe this is a very vital bill, and we have been advocating for it for a long time, and we would like to see it this session. I would like the bill to go to the floor with not the -2 amendments.
What -2 amendments?
I think that you have -2 amendments in testimony.
Thank you. Ms. Reed.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Astrid Newell. I am the medical consultant for the Office of Family Health.
within the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 236, and in the interest of time, I've prepared written testimony, but I just want to say that the Office of Family Health and Department of Human Services feels that this bill is good public health policy, and the previous individual who testified indicated some of the important health consequences that result from unintended pregnancy. In addition to abortions, there are also the late entry into prenatal care, or actually no prenatal care, significant effects of exposure of the fetus to harmful substances, alcohol, drugs, etc. There's an increased incidence of maternal depression and dissolution of relationships with fathers related to unintended pregnancies. So this is these are significant issues in it, over and above the issue of abortion. And we do support this bill, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions. Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And seeing no others signed up to...
I want to comment.
Oh, a comment.
Close the public hearing.
Thank you. Go ahead. Comments?
I'm disappointed we don't have any insurance industry folks here today, because I wanted to ask this question, and perhaps I can coordinate with Maura Roach on doing a survey. I recently did a survey on breast cancer reconstruction, and so I do have the list of... There's over 800 insurance companies in Oregon, but there's about 25 that are pretty large. And the question I would ask is, first, do you cover contraceptives for women? And then the second most important question that I think needs to be asked, and you raised it earlier, is do these insurance companies cover Viagra or any other medication or device that assists men in their ability to engage in reproductive type activities? And I think that is a very valid question that needs to be asked and surveyed so that we can get to the bottom of this issue about discrimination. And I actually think we can get to that issue without this question, but I, for one, am quite curious about this question. So if you are listening out there, insurance lobby, be prepared for this question to come your way. And thank you all for testifying today. We really appreciate it.
Okay. We have 2.5 minutes to kill. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you all for being here.